Hello, this is the Global News Podcast from the BBC World Service with reports and analysis from across the world. The latest news 7 days a week. BBC World Service podcasts are supported by advertising.
I'm Katia Adler from the Global Story Podcast, where we're looking at the dark side of the perfume industry. A BBC investigation has exposed young children working through the night picking jasmine, which eventually makes its way into our expensive bottles of fragrance. The Global Story brings you fresh takes and smart perspectives from BBC journalists around the world. Find us wherever you get your BBC podcasts.
This is the Global News Podcast from the BBC World Service. I'm Andrew Peach, and at 13 hours GMT on Wednesday the 28th of May, these are our main stories. There are reports of tanks reaching the centre of Rafah as Israel intensifies its military operation despite condemnation over the deaths of Palestinian civilians. Three more nations officially recognise Palestine as a state. It's crunch time in Georgia as Parliament votes on its divisive foreign agents law, a move many see as a step away from the West and towards Russia. Also in this podcast, on the eve of South Africa's elections, we look at the length some people in the post-apartheid South Africa go to find a home.
It was a toilet before.
It was a toilet?
Yes.
And now you have a kitchen.
I have a
in
kitchen.
In one of the toilet departments.
This place actually gave me a bit of home.
And why an album no one's heard has got top billing at a museum in Australia. Israel's forces have moved deeper into Rafah in southern Gaza as it carries out its most intense bombardment of the city since it began its military operation there 3 weeks ago. Israel say it's an offensive that's necessary to destroy the remaining Hamas battalions there and free hostages. But the cost of Palestinian lives has been high. On Sunday, 45 people in a camp for displaced people were killed, and strikes on the night of Monday into Tuesday killed 16 more, according to Hamas officials. There are now reports that several Israeli tanks have reached the centre of Rafah. Hundreds of families have had to flee.
We woke up at 6 in the morning from the shelling and rockets. We don't know where we're going. We don't have tents. We don't have anything. We have children with us, and my aunt and my mother-in-law are under the shelling, and I must go and get them.
I'm just walking in the street. I don't know where to come or go. They say that we should go somewhere safe. There is nowhere safe. There is no area that is safe. This is not a life.
Just before we recorded this podcast, I got the latest on the movements of those Israeli military tanks in Rafah from our Middle East correspondent, Yolan Nell, in Jerusalem.
We've not heard anything officially from the Israeli military about the movements of its ground troops, but we've got witnesses in Rafah telling us that they have now reached the heart of the city, really, the Al Awda roundabout. That's a key landmark. One witness told us that there was a sniper or many snipers set up on a tall building. We haven't got a full confirmation of exactly what is happening there. We do know as well that there were reports earlier that Israeli forces had seized control of the highest hilltop along the Gaza-Egypt border, this area that's known as the Philadelphia Corridor. A large part of this corridor, strategically important, of course, now under Israeli control. There are reported being gun battles with Hamas-led fighters there. And we also know that there was overnight a shootout between Egyptian soldiers along the border and Israeli soldiers, that resulted in one Egyptian officer being killed. In general, intense Israeli airstrikes, artillery fire, that went on overnight. People told us it was terrifying that they got up early this morning from homes in the west of Rafah. Thousands of people could be seen fleeing from that part of the city, piling up their possessions in those scenes that have become all too familiar from Gaza. And people also moving from that tent camp, Tel Sultan, where there was this deadly Israeli bombing on Sunday that ignited a huge blaze there, what the Israeli Prime Minister has called a tragic mishap.
The UN Security Council are meeting to talk about this later, although Israel seems undaunted by any level of international condemnation.
Yeah, so we have this meeting taking place behind closed doors later. It was called by Algeria in response to that deadly airstrike on Sunday night. The UN has already called for a full and transparent investigation into what happened. We had last week the top UN court basically ordering Israel to stop its Rafah offensive, although it argues that there is some scope for military action left by the wording of the ruling. And on the world stage, you know, Israel does just look more and more isolated.
Yola Nell with me from Jerusalem. Meanwhile, Spain, Ireland and Norway have all officially recognised the state of Palestine. It was an initiative begun by the Spanish Prime Minister, Pedro Sanchez.
With this decision, Spain joins the more than 140 countries that already recognise Palestine. This is a historic decision that has a single goal, to contribute to achieving peace between Israelis and Palestinians.
But it may not be enough for these people, who are among hundreds of pro-Palestinian protesters who gathered on Monday in Barcelona and Madrid.
We need more from the state of Spain. We don't want only the declaration of a Palestinian state, because that's something more symbolic than anything. We ask for the government to cut relations with the state of Israel. Not just that, we want them to stop selling and buying arms from the state of Israel, because that makes Spain complice of the genocide that is going on in Palestine.
The next step is a blockage to Israel and then starting negotiations to recognize both states in the same territory.
Hamas and the Palestinian Authority have welcomed the recognition. Israel's Foreign Affairs Minister, Israel Katz, shared a video on X. Mixed images of flamenco dancers with Hamas fighters attacking Israel on the 7th of October, with a message to the Spanish president that Hamas thanks him for his service. Israel has accused all three countries of rewarding terrorism and has withdrawn its ambassadors. Our correspondent in Madrid is Guy Hedgeco.
Mr. Sanchez has been very keen to promote this initiative, and we saw him there speaking in English. That reflects how significant he feels this is. He said he had to speak in Spanish and English because it was such an internationally important moment. Mr. Sanchez has argued that it reflects public opinion, and polls do suggest that. In terms of the political reaction, broadly, I suppose you could say it does have support, certainly from the left and his allies on the left. They're very much in support of this. In fact, many think that this announcement should have been made previously. On the right, it's a little more complicated. The main conservative People's Party says it does support a two-state solution, but it has criticised him for the way that he's gone about this. It says he's gone about it too fast, and that's why he hasn't got more support from other countries. And they also say that he's been trying to sort of hog the limelight as well. The feeling is that, above all, this is a symbolic move. And I think what Pedro Sanchez and his government hope is that this will somehow encourage other countries, particularly in Europe, to take similar steps in the near future.
Guy Hedgeco in Madrid. 30 years on from South Africa's first democratic election and the end of apartheid, the country is on the eve of voting in a new parliament. The party that brought an end to apartheid, the African National Congress, the ANC, have always had a parliamentary majority. This time there's the very real prospect that it might sink below 50% of the votes, raising the prospect of a coalition government. Some people are still grappling with how to reverse the geography of apartheid, the white minority rule, which determined where and how people lived. Our Africa correspondent Barbara Platt-Usher has been to Cape Town, where the contrasts are particularly stark.
Good. This is an afternoon Arabic lesson, practice for reading the Quran. Children are clustered around two tables in a long room. They're in a derelict hospital that's under occupation by people who got tired of waiting for government housing and took matters into their own hands. Jamila Davids is one of them.
I found something and I ended up in the old morgue office. And everyone's like, why are you living in the morgue? I said, well, you know what? It's home now. It's a place I can call home.
Another resident, Feldila Peterson, shows me how she's transformed a bathroom into a home.
It was a toilet before.
It was a toilet?
Yes.
And now what, you have a kitchen?
I have a
in
kitchen.
In one of the toilet departments?
This place actually gave me a bit of more home. Like a homecoming. I was evicted like 10 times in a year. But living in this occupation gave me that opportunity to look my life a bit better. And it's much more nearer to the city as well.
And that's the point. This is all about location.
So we have probably around about 1,500 people living here.
Bevel Lucas is one of the social rights activists who organized the hospital takeover.
It was occupation for the purpose of being centrally located. It's close to the city centre. It's close to economic activities. It's close to transport.
Under apartheid, racist laws banished black and coloured people to the peripheries of cities. Now they have the right to move, but many can't afford to. The ANC government has built housing, but most of it far from the city centre, where land is cheaper, which has served to reinforce the geography of apartheid.
Cape Town really is probably the most segregated urban area anywhere on earth. So, I mean, still today, not a single affordable home has been built in the inner city of Cape Town.
Nick Budlander is an urban policy researcher. He's giving me a tour of parking lots that store government vehicles, identified by activists as available public land that could be transformed into low-income housing.
This one really irritates me because it's just filled with broken cars. I think it's an absolutely egregious example that in an area like this that so many people would benefit from living in, the decision is rather to just have cars covered in dust.
There are signs of a new government approach.
I'm now at another former hospital site, and there is construction going on here because the provincial government is building low-cost housing just a few kilometres from the city centre. Some has already been completed, and people have moved in and are paying low rents. But really, this is just a drop in the bucket compared to what's needed.
The section we are walking in now is affordable housing, which is a rental option.
The provincial infrastructure minister, Tertius Simmers, acknowledges a backlog of 600,000 people waiting for housing assistance, but says they're working on it.
We are very ambitious for our next five-year cycle of in terms of delivery. We have 29 social housing projects similar to this plan within our project pipeline at various stages.
But the budgets are small and timelines uncertain.
It's Saturday morning in Khayelitsha Township, which is several kilometres outside of Cape Town. Sounds like the church services have already started. There are rows and rows and rows of shacks made of corrugated iron, also rows of public latrines. People are getting water from a communal tap.
Noliema Tetekome has lived in a shack here for most of her 49 years. She spends a quarter of her meagre salary on transport to her job in the city. And she does not expect the election to change that.
I'm not going to vote this year because I'm tired about the vote. Because I was vote before, but didn't see change. Still, I'm staying here.
The end of apartheid did bring political rights and freedoms for all. But on the eve of South Africa's seventh democratic election, enduring inequality still divides this country.
Police in Hong Kong have arrested six people for writing messages which the authorities say advocated rebellion against the state. The arrests of five women and one man are the first of their kind under the Chinese territory's own security law. Here's Celia Hatton.
The arrests come ahead of a politically sensitive date in Hong Kong and mainland China, June 4th. In the past, before Hong Kong tightened its security laws to outlaw political dissent, thousands of people would gather in Hong Kong to remember pro-democracy demonstrators killed near Beijing's Tiananmen Square on June 4, 1989. Such commemorative events have now been deemed illegal. The authorities say those arrested on Tuesday include the noted political activist Chow Hung Tung, who was part of a group dedicated to remembering June 4th. Ms. Chow, who's already behind bars, is accused of pushing the others to share messages connected with a sensitive date.
Celia Hatton reporting. Still to come, a special report from the besieged Ukrainian city of Kharkiv.
It's scary. I hope that Russia was not a terrorist state, but they hit civilian places now too. The Russians are killing civilians, and we have nothing to defend ourselves.
I'm Katia Adler from the Global Story podcast, where we're looking at the dark side of the perfume industry. A BBC investigation has exposed young children working through the night picking jasmine, which eventually makes its way into our expensive bottles of fragrance. The Global Story brings you fresh takes and smart perspectives from BBC journalists around the world. Find us wherever you get your BBC podcasts.
As we record this podcast, Georgia's parliament is expected to push through its divisive foreign agents law, a move many see as a step away from the West and towards Russia. The policy sparked weeks of protests. It's already received a presidential veto, but the ruling Georgian Dream Party has been saying it'll overturn that. Opponents of the law fear it could be used to stifle dissent and make it impossible for Georgia to join the European Union.
Our whole future is at stake. If we're not with Europe, we have no other choice. Like, it's either Europe or nothing.
I think actually today is one of the worst days of Georgian history. So even though we're on a fighting mode to fight the Russian law till the end, I think all of us are a bit upset because seeing that it is all done by Georgian hands is super hard.
We've got to say no for Russia because Europe is only choice for us and our future should be European.
With the vote imminent, I spoke to Rehan Dimitri outside the Parliament building in Tbilisi.
They are here, the protesters. It's hard to tell how many are here. They're making quite a lot of noise. There's also quite a lot of police on site. And at this stage, most of the protesters are kind of at the back entrance to the parliament. Very poor mobile connection here, but still I can see a lot of people are trying to watch on their phones what's happening inside parliament. And this vote to override the presidential veto is to happen any minute now, and they know that the governing Georgian Dream Party will override this veto because that's what they've been announcing over and over again. And we're asking protesters, so what's next for you? What are you going to do? You've been protesting for more than 6 weeks, and they're saying that the only way for them is to continue their protest because this is not just about the law, it is about Georgia's future. And those who are protesting against this law, they want to see the future of their country in Europe. And they believe that if this law is enacted in Georgia, it will suppress dissent, it will suppress critical voices. They call it the Russian law because of the similarities with the foreign agents law in Russia. And they just don't want to see the same thing happen here.
And barring the government changing its mind, which seems unlikely, is that it? When the presidential veto is overturned any moment, as we expect, it becomes law and that's that. People can protest if they want to.
Most of the non-governmental organizations and independent media that this law would target, they have already said that they won't comply. They disagree with it. And it means that perhaps a lot of non-governmental organizations will be shut. All of this is happening just months before the parliamentary elections in October.
Ray Dimitri with me from Tbilisi. Belgium has become the latest European country to say it'll send F-16 fighter jets to Ukraine as part of a package of aid worth nearly $1 billion. The Netherlands, Denmark and Norway have already promised to send F-16s to help Ukraine fend off Russian attacks. The Belgian Prime Minister, Alexander De Croo, made the commitment to send 30 jets, stressing the urgency.
Let me be very clear. Ukraine can only push back the invader if we provide more and if we provide better arms and if we are able to do it in a faster pace. As Europeans, as NATO members, we fully acknowledge the need for that and we fully acknowledge your demand for that.
Russia has been increasing the military pressure on Ukraine and particularly the country's second city, Kharkiv. Two guided bombs destroyed a shop and a garden centre crowded with people on Saturday. Our international editor Jeremy Bowen reports from the city, which is feeling very much under siege.
Well, we're in the cellar under our hotel in Kharkiv because there have been a number of big explosions. And there have been reports as well of ballistic missiles coming into the city, so we're taking cover. Once we get the all clear, we're going to head over to the scene. So I've got inside the printworks that was hit in the Russian attack. The roof's gone, there's smoke. It's hard to know why the Russians hit this place. But what is absolutely certain is that
the Ukrainians weren't able to stop them. Not one of the missiles was intercepted. The war right now is about hard choices for Ukraine, because they're fighting an enemy that realizes their weaknesses and has worked out how to exploit them.
Days after the attack, Olena Lupak, one of the workers at the plant, was still in hospital, battered and cut by blast and shrapnel. Her hair was badly singed where it had caught fire, and Olena, for the first time in the war, was terrified.
It's scary. I hope that Russia was not a terrorist state and would only attack military targets. But they hit civilian places now too, and I'm really scared. The Russians are killing civilians, and we have nothing to defend ourselves.
And the Russians are not very far away. The border is close. They're hitting Kharkiv. Is it worse than this time last year?
This is the middle of the war. It's not like it was at the beginning, but this is not the end. We are still in the middle of it.
We're bumping along an improvised road through a field. I can see massive plumes of smoke coming from Vovchansk. That's the place which has been the center of the fighting. There are multiple fires burning. I can see that black smoke towering into the sky. Must be pretty hellish to be in there. Mercifully, we are quite away from it. Davika, the psychologist, is having a conversation with the lady behind the gate. What do they say?
So she persuades her to leave. She says she will get any kind of support she needs, anything she needs.
She doesn't want to go?
Very dangerous to stay here. Please, could you please leave? It's getting more and more dangerous.
So a few streets away in the village, there's Lyubov. She's an elderly woman. She's packed and ready to go after more than 40 years in the same house. Leaving hurts my soul, she told me, but the shelling made sleep impossible and it was so close that all her windows were smashed.
You think you'll be back soon?
We'll see. It depends on if it's Russians or Ukrainians here. That's going to make my decision for me.
Kharkiv isn't just a city of war. It's a beautiful early summer day. Cafes are open, and outside the opera house, boys are skateboarding on the stone steps, practicing jumps. And inside, they're still playing music. They've improvised a war theatre, and the orchestra is here rehearsing for a music festival. But that can't obscure Ukraine's real challenges and the tenacity and the strength of the Russians and the hard summer that lies ahead.
Jeremy Bowen reporting from Kharkiv. Pope Francis has been heard using a highly derogatory term for gay people. He was speaking a week ago in a private meeting with Italian bishops. As we record this podcast, the Vatican has issued a statement saying the Pope didn't intend to use homophobic language and apologises to anyone offended. Our religion editor Ali Makbul reports on the incident.
When asked at the Italian bishops' conference if gay men should now be allowed to train for the priesthood as long as they remain celibate, Pope Francis is reported to have said no, saying there was, in the church, already too much of an air of, in Italian, fracciagine, which translates as an extremely offensive reference to homosexual behaviour. There was said to have been shock at the Pope's language during the closed-doors meeting, particularly as he has, in public, talked of being respectful towards gay people. Progressive supporters of the Pope have long argued that while little has tangibly changed in terms of gay rights in Catholicism, Pope Francis has changed the tone of the Church's attitude.
Our religion editor, Ali Makbul. Sri Lanka's economy is on track to stabilise this year after a severe financial crisis which plunged a quarter of the country into poverty. But the government has sparked concern by ordering the country's tea producers to increase wages by 70%. Plantation companies are worried it'll make their tea uncompetitive. So how important is tea to the Sri Lankan economy? Victoria Uwanhunda spoke to our business correspondent, Monica Miller.
It is massive. It is $1.3 billion worth of Ceylon tea, and it employs about 615,000 workers. And the Sri Lanka annually exports about 95% of roughly about 250 million kilos of tea it produces. So the government has ordered its workers' salaries to be increased to $5.66 in U.S. dollars per day. Now, that is from what they are currently being paid of $3.33, which the industry says will increase tea production and costs by about 45%. However, representatives of the plantation say that this increase is going to make it much, much harder to compete against its key rivals, India and Kenya, which have lower prices and higher productivity. So the industry needs to start paying these increases, according to the government, starting next month.
So we've talked so many times here on the program about the challenges that have been and the struggles that Sri Lankan economy has been going through for the last few years. Just remind us briefly those challenges.
Well, the fallout from Sri Lanka's financial crisis, I mean, this goes back to last year. Actually, you know, it had been building up that there were some issues with fallouts from foreign exchange in 2022. That leader at the time, Mr. Rajapaksa, had left the country because there just wasn't currencies. The U.S. dollar they ran out of, which was paying things for imports, fuel, medical supplies. There were food shortages. It got incredibly bad. And that was after the COVID pandemic.
Now, do you recognize this? This is the sound of the Wu-Tang Clan, formed in Staten Island, New York in 1992, and widely regarded as one of the most influential hip-hop bands of all time. Unique CD by the collective, whose members include Method Man, Inspector Deck, and Ghostface Killah, is being given top billing at a museum on the other side of the world in Tasmania. I asked Tiffany Turnbull in Sydney what's so special about the album.
It's housed in this ornate silver box. Inside is apparently a CD, the only copy of this album in the world. It comes with a leather-bound book of lyrics, and it's been loaned to this museum in Tasmania where it will be put on physical display, but it'll also be played for a select number of people.
And the idea, as I understand it, of the album was a sort of rebellion against streaming, which the band thought made music too widely available, less of a precious commodity.
Yeah, the band has said that they wanted to kind of take it back to a 400-year-old Renaissance-style approach to music where they were offering this really highly sought-after commodity. Their producer likened it to a Picasso artwork or an ancient Egyptian artifact, and the museum says that they're helping this vision come to life because obviously only a few people will be able to listen to it, but it'll also be housed alongside all of these other pieces of fine art where it belongs, the museum says.
And the value of it makes it very elite, very inaccessible to most people.
Yeah, so because it is so rare, being literally the only copy of this album at all, it sold for $2 million way back in 2015, and that went to Martin Shkreli, the disgraced former pharmaceutical executive. And when his assets were seized, it was sold again, reportedly for about double that. So it is the most expensive album ever sold.
Unsurprising it was recorded in New York, but maybe more surprising, it's ended up in Tasmania. Why there?
Well, the museum that's putting on this exhibit is very well known for, I guess, stunts like this, exhibitions that make people think. And that museum in Hobart, called the Museum of Old and New Art, they're doing a exhibition about name dropping, which is about status and notoriety and celebrity. And the curator said that he couldn't think of anything else that he wanted more than this album that could demonstrate those themes.
Tiffany Turnbull with me from Sydney. And that's all from us for now. There'll be a new edition of Global News to download later. If you'd like to comment on this podcast and the stories we included, drop us an email, globalpodcast@bbc.co.uk, or on X, we are @globalnewspod. This edition was mixed by Pat Sissons. The producer was Marion Straw, and the editor is Karen Martin. I'm Andrew Peach. Thanks for listening. And until next time, goodbye.
I'm Katia Adler from the Global Story podcast, where we're looking at the dark side of the perfume industry. A BBC investigation has exposed young children working through the night picking jasmine, which eventually makes its way into our expensive bottles of fragrance. The Global Story brings you fresh takes and smart perspectives from BBC journalists around the world. Find us wherever you get your BBC podcasts.